This is Jason Horsley for The Liminalist, the podcast between. This week I'm talking to Charles Upton. Here we are. Yeah, I heard you saying your prayer to Michael, so maybe that's what did it.
Yeah, right. I mean, I believe subtle forces can interact with electronics more easily than with anything else.
Absolutely.
Because, you know, at one end of their world is the electromagnetic spectrum, you know.
Yes, I think it's going to be getting increasingly strange in that regard, as the interface between...
You know, Dugan, I'm asking myself, because I've been feeling a lot, you know, there's a lot of disruption in my life, which I won't go into, but I feel, you know, it sort of started with the Dugan book, and then I'm saying, are these just what I like to call the psychic minefields surrounding Dugan, you know, or is it something more active being done on his end? I don't know. I mean, he certainly claims to be a magician and says that's the praxis of his fourth political theory is magic. So,
well, let's jump right in there then with Dugan and keeping in mind that probably many of the listeners of The Liminalist will be no more familiar with Dugan than I was. So maybe if you could just start from the very basics. Who is this Dugan? How did you get interested in him? And what are you trying to achieve by writing a book about him?
Well, Professor Alexander Dugan is a political theorist and political organizer from Russia. He's pretty much a Kremlin insider, although he operates very independently. My view is he's sort of Putin's berserker who goes out and, you know, makes all sorts of contacts through his wild way of operating, you know, like connecting with many, many different political, religious, and I believe esoteric groups, speaking to each one of them in their own language in order to get them to identify with what he's doing. And what he's doing is trying to put together a neo-Eurasian movement, which is basically organizing a world revolution of all the entities, political or otherwise, who feel oppressed by the United States and the U.S. Empire, you know, in order to bring down the U.S. Empire. So he's very much involved in the alt-right in this country and in Europe. You know, I was watching him on, you know, connecting with him on Facebook for a short time before he unfriended me, and he was just deeply involved in the yellow vest revolution, whatever was going on in France, and you know, and he was in contact with all sorts of political groups and political esoteric groups, and right wing pagan organizations and stuff like this. So, anyway, his theory, supposedly a political theory, but it's sort of his hodgepodge theory of everything is called the Fourth Political Theory. That's the title of one of his books. He's also got one called The Rise of the Fourth Political Theory. Anyway, how did I get interested? Well, he claims to be a traditionalist, who one of the people he claims to follow is René Guénon, and of course René Guénon founded the school of traditionalism or perennialism that I pretty much follow, following a different branch, you know, in which the big names are Fritjof Schoen and Martin Lings and Titus Burkhardt. You know, on that end of it, it is a school of traditional metaphysics and comparative religion, and actually one of the most intelligent and thorough treatments of those things. Although I don't absolutely agree with everything they say, they're pretty much what has formed a great deal of my intellectual outlook at this point. And then Dugan comes along. It says, well, I'm a traditionalist too. Okay, René Guénon, sure. I mean, he raises the René Guénon flag because he wants to bring in the people who identify with that. He raises the Eastern Orthodox flag to bring in people who identify with that. He raises the alt-right flag to bring in people who identify with that, et cetera. He raises the pagan flag to bring in those people. Mm. And his explanation or description of doing this, he says, what we are divides us, what we are against unites us. Hmm. So all of these, you know, he appeals. He's more neo-fascist probably politically than anything else. But also he appeals to extreme left groups, and you know, great. They're all against the U.S. But what happens if they win? You know, they'll tear each other to shreds. But he's not. You know, maybe he has some idea of how he will deal with that. I don't know. But in any case, he's been sort of big in alt-right circles. But what has mattered to me is he is taking the name René Guénon, the term traditionalism, which means a great deal to me in my spiritual life, and just applying it to things that have nothing whatsoever to do with anything René Guénon said. Now, this was started, you know, to move away from René Guénon, who is essentially a metaphysician, in the direction of politics. Baron Julius Evola in Italy took a big step in that direction. But then there's a lot of people who just, you know, identify with Guénon because Guénon wrote a book, this is my analysis, called The Crisis of the Modern World, in which he says, you know, that the spiritual intellectuals have to save Western civilization. And this gives a very high position to the intellectual, so a lot of intellectuals are attracted to it. But I've run into academics who said, well, yes, I'm a follower of René Guénon, but I'm not interested in his metaphysics, you know, which is absurd because that's everything he wrote except for a few suggestions that might go in a political direction. But that's not what he was doing. It's like saying, oh, yeah, I'm into Johann Sebastian Bach, but I'm not into his music, you know. So, you know, it's... So anyway, and so these people, you know... Dugin is walking into my world and taking the name of it and doing things that I and most of the people that I know in this world would not touch with a 10-foot pole. So I feel he's poaching, you know, and I feel it's dishonest. So, you know, that's what got my dander up.
Mm-hmm. So. And have you had any response from Dugin thus far to your attempts?
Well, he now is not responding. For a moment, I connected on Facebook at one point, and I just said, you know, let's, you know, I agree with you, and I do agree with him in some places. I say, you know, he has expressed, you know, the real gravity of the human situation very well, you know, and you know, he's faced it more completely than most people ever do. And also, he's got a very good critique of liberalism and postmodernism. You know, because I think postmodern liberalism has become, well, it's not what liberalism used to be by any means. You know, it's got the same name, but it's inverted. It's become something else. The left in the United States is in some ways, the exact opposite, 180 degrees of what it was in, let's say, the 1980s, when I was active, you know, in the peace movement. Totally different animal. So, in any case, I didn't appreciate his taking the name of traditionalism. So what I did, I connected with him, and I said some things like this, you know, I accept a lot of what you say, but, you know, I can't go along with what you're doing with traditionalism. And I also said, okay, you say you're the great champion against postmodernism, but there's no thinker who is more postmodern than you. Everything you do is postmodern. Everything is contradictory. There is no objective truth, you know, and that's pure postmodernism. So I said this, you know, and he said, well, I don't know if I want to dialogue with you because you sound too aggressive. Sure. So I said, well, you've said that war between the United States and Russia is inevitable, right? So I thought, since that is your position, you wouldn't worry about a little verbal aggression here and there because, you know, you're way ahead of me in that field. And, you know, he says, we traditionalists should stick together. And then I just said, you're not a traditionalist. You just hijacked a name. You know, I think after that, he didn't want to talk to me anymore. Or if he's seen my book, what my book is called Dugin Against Dugin, A Traditionalist Critique of the Fourth Political Theory. And, you know, I sent him the PDF, but if he's read it, he sees it'll be extremely embarrassing for him to have to dialogue with me because I've just pointed out just egregious, absolute contradictions,
mm-hmm.
which either can only be explained by somebody who has mental problems, you know, like beginning dementia or something like this, or someone who is doing deliberate contradictions in order to you know, cast dust in our eyes so we can't see. What happens with contradictions? If people accept a contradictory statements, particularly if they accept them unconsciously, then their critical faculties are stunned.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they can no longer say, this is true, this is not true. They're just, you know, and they become extremely suggestible. And then once that happens, you know, various elements can be projected toward that person, which he will identify with. And, you know, that this is a method of, it's a hypnotic technique. And it's very useful in certain kinds of political organizing.
Yeah, well, that's a very interesting point. I actually just blogged something similar about that, this idea of schismogenesis, which is the creation of a split. But that's a very large subject, so I wanted to stay on the specifics, first of all. And there's some interesting parallels with what you're doing with Dugin, and what I've been trying to do or was doing with Whitley Strieber over recent mm-hmm. years, because I wrote Prisoner Infinity, and he certainly became aware of it, and he's not been open to dialogue about it. And one of the problems I have with Strieber, similar to what you're expressing now, is it's difficult to tell the difference between the internal schism in Strieber's own psyche, the fragmentation, you know, and hence the contradictions, the endless contradictions in Strieber's work, and deliberate deception and manipulation and confabulation.
Yes, it's very hard to tell. And you know, because postmodern discourse is filled with that contradictory tendency. So when you look at an intellectual writing like that, you say, I mean, I say to myself, if I were to write something like that, I would just be dishonest.
Mm.
I mean, that's just, you know, but is this the way people now, is this all they have intellectually to work with, is contradictions, and they feel that, you know, the saying contradictory things is intriguing and paradoxical and mystical and whatever excuses they give. I don't know, but I mean, that's, it's certainly, postmodernism is very much like I described, you know, of you know, stunning your critical faculties by hatching contradictions.
Right.
Very hard to answer that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and it raises the question, at least in my mind, how much postmodernism is a symptom itself rather than the cause. Although, of course, it's also causing, it's intensifying this split. But it seems that it's also symptomatic of it, the attempt of individuals and collectives to make sense of a traumatized experience of reality.
Yes.
By coming up with these yarns, these endless sort of philosophical distortions and perceptual interpretations of reality that just intensify the confusion.
Yes, and the one thing that has saved me from postmodernism in the sense you just described, and has allowed me to work to expose some of the errors of postmodernism, is traditionalism, is traditional metaphysics.
Mm.
This is something that is supremely consistent, although it's not a closed system, but it is supremely consistent. And from the standpoint of that science, you can look at the distortions, intellectual distortions of the modern world, and just see exactly what they're doing, where they came from, and why they're wrong, and how they could be mended. You know, and so this is doubly frustrating when Dugin comes along and says, "Well, I'm a traditionalist too," you know, and I'm against postmodernism, but you know, in effect, he's a pure postmodernist. So you know, what you know, talk about muddying the waters. I mean, so
yeah, well, it's difficult to talk about on a, you know, a sociological level, because I'm already getting confused in my thoughts and how to formulate my questions here. But so, for example, you were saying that Dugin's appealing to the alt-right, and but part of the appeal or the thrust of his message is anti-Americanism, And the thing about the alt-right, well, a lot of them are quite in favor of Donald Trump. I mean, the alt-right is a tricky term, isn't it? Because it's
Yes,
questionable about whether it
it hasn't
exists.
gelled to be one thing, you know.
Yeah,
You
yeah.
could say Richard Spencer is the alt-right, but that's just because, you know, he nabbed that domain name for his website, you know. That's his claim to that name. You know, he's one of a very, you know, heterogeneous mix.
Well, let's bring it to maybe a more philosophical point about my sense about what's being called the alt-right, but not only that, a sort of a growing collective reaction against postmodernism, let's say, is this attempt to rediscover the ground of objective reality. So that would include, I think you mentioned some of the things that rad trad or whatever, radical traditionalism, even the Christianity, the rising appeal of Christianity or some pseudo kind of Christianity anyway, seems to relate to that. So yeah, people are they're grasping more and more for a more objective sense of reality, and that you're saying that that's what traditional metaphysics provides potentially, at least for yourself.
That is what it provides. Now, Dugin is against universalism. Dugin says, you know, in a certain sense, every religion, every thought system, every ethnic group, you know, they have their own realities, and, you know, each must be, you know, given equal weight. You know, talk about celebrating diversity, and then he wants to bring them all together into a single movement, which is essentially spearheaded by Russia. You know, and it's and when my colleague, Dr. John Andrew Morrow, this is an interesting story. You know, he's my colleague in the Covenants Initiative, which is all a whole other story. You know, it's an international Muslim peace movement. He was in Iraq at the Arba'in pilgrimage, where the Shia make pilgrimage to the sacred sites, you know, where Ali and Hussein and such were martyred, and it's a huge pilgrimage with millions of people. He was there, and he spent some days with Alexander Dugin, talking with him, because Dugin was on a Shia pilgrimage, being, on the one hand, an Eastern Orthodox Christian, on the other hand, a declared magician, on the other hand, you know, a political ideologue of both the right and the left. But there he was with the Shia. You know, Dr. Morrow, you know, wrote back to me and said, Alexander Dugin is a very humble and very pious person who simply, you know, wants all of the nations and peoples who've been oppressed by the West, by the U.S. Empire, you know, to be free, to pursue their own self-determination. And, you know, and luckily I was already working on my Dugin book, so I sent him some of the stuff I found where, you know, he totally trashes Islam in the belief that he's supporting it, and you know, calls himself a magician and says we need World War III and all this, and then the scales fell off Dr. Morrow's eyes, and he said, this guy is Dajjal, you know, is Antichrist. That's the Muslim Antichrist. You know, Dugin is a large field of many different subjects, and it's hard to maintain a straight line through him. So ask me some more questions.
Well,
You know.
there's one I didn't get to. Another parallel with Strieber, but was the third problem I had with Strieber, or however many I've lost count actually. But one of the central ones, besides not being able to tell the difference between lying, confabulation, and delusion, you know, it was not knowing whether Strieber was really operating independently or whether he was a mouthpiece for a larger, you know, group of
Yes, of
individuals.
course. And you don't know whether these groups are, you know, we have to at this point say, or I have to, we don't know whether these groups are human or non-human.
Right.
You know, I mean, you could say these people are speaking for, you know, powers that be in the world, or, you know, in fact, one of Dugin's, apparently Dugin's, you know, source of funding is a Konstantin Malofeyev, if I pronounce that correctly, is one of the Russian oligarchs. Of course, you know, his and Dugin's, you know, fourth political theory, the oligarchs are one of the enemies. You know, we don't like the oligarchs. Well, okay. or you know, because at one point, when you go back to who's behind who, you know, follow the paranoid conspiracy line, you will get to dark spiritual forces.
Mm-hmm.
And we're getting closer to being able to see that in many different directions as the next step in asking the question, who's behind all this? We're getting closer to this, which is unfortunate, but on the other hand, you know, that if that's what's really going on, then potentially we can really deal with it and not just deal with, you know, secondary symptoms.
Mm. Well, one of the things that was helpful for me, and I'd be interested to know if you've had something similar writing about Dugin while I was writing about Strieber, was that I was really just looking at one man, and even regardless of whether he was nested in a larger conspiracy, which yeah. I have no doubt that he is, looking at his own psyche was sufficient to really gain a deeper understanding of how these forces work in the world, and how it's not really an either-or, is it? It's a spectrum. It's not either he's independent or he's part of a group, either he's lying, he's telling the truth, either he's
right.
demonic or he's, you know, angelic.
Yeah.
It's
I hope I won't be considered to be a sexist when I say this is a question that men have always asked about manipulative women, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, does she know she's doing this to me, or is it just pure innocent instinct that's driving me nuts, you know? And it's very hard to tell. I mean, Dorothy, the sort of satirical writer, Dorothy Parker, in one of her short stories, had a wonderful line where a woman is saying, you know, she says, you know, that these really were my true feelings, she insisted, even though I was exploiting them. You know, so in other words, this is possible. You know, it's possible to play a double game like that—to be sincere, and at the same time, you know, be manipulative.
It's actually a great deal more effective, isn't it? Because I mean,
it is.
In that archetypal example you're giving of the woman who manipulates women, men with her sexuality, the innocent, guileless knife is very central to that, the spell that a woman of that kind can cast. And somebody like Strieber has that. Like, if you listen to Strieber, and I don't recommend it, but I still find myself doing it occasionally, it's very confounding. I mean, talk about creating cognitive dissonance at a deep level. Like, I know that Strieber's lying and deluded a lot of the time, but then suddenly another part of him will kick in, and he's so incredibly sincere, and he's talking about some very profound possible truth, and it's
exactly.
all mixed up together, you know?
Well, and that describes Dugin quite well. And you know, what is often said is the devil will tell you 9 truths in order to get you to believe 1 lie.
Yeah.
And, you know, let's see. In Dante's Inferno, there's a being called Geryon, who is the spirit of fraud. And it's very interesting. You know, he's a monster, but he has the face of an honest man, you know, human head and face of the honest man, and then he has the torso of you know, a warm furry mammal of some kind, and then he has the lower parts of a serpent, and then finally in the tail he has the sting of a scorpion. And you know, what this is, what deception has to do is appropriate honesty, appropriate truth, pervert truth, use truth to build or to give power to the lie. Because where else is the lie going to get any power? You know, a lie is simply a negation on its own. It's got nothing to work with. It has to be a parasite on truth, you know.
Yeah, and I think one of the ways that works, again, I'm observing with Strieber and writing about him, is if you create a counterfeit of the truth that is much more attractive and alluring than, than the actual truth, then people will reject the truth when they come upon it.
Yes, they will forget it. They won't recognize it, or you know, even if they've seen the problems with the thing that has that has hijacked their belief, that they will come out of that wounded and cynical, and they won't believe anything. You know, I mean, you know, those are the two dark outcomes. One is you become completely fascinated with a lie. The other one is you wake up to the fact that that was a lie, but then now you think everything's a lie. There's no such thing as truth, and you're not going to be fooled again. So when truth comes to you, you say, "Ah, I've been there and done that." You know.
I've been trying to see you, to tell you the truth, that I've been losing sleep at night, trying to untie you, but no, you won't release yourself, oh no, you won't release yourself, no, you won't release yourself from me. You lie out in the cool grass, pray for someone who'll take you far away from me, where I can do you harm, but no, you won't release yourself, oh no, you won't release yourself, oh no, you won't release yourself.
What did you think with Dugan? One of the things he said there is that he said was, we're divided by ourselves, but we're united by what we're against.
Yeah.
That psychologically, that's a negative identity, as in a sense of self that can only exist by finding things to oppose. That's a very unhealthy state for the psyche to be in.
Yeah, because it's saying, you know, if in other words, in truth, you know, what things really are unites them, because in truth, all things are manifestations of the divine, and it's their unity is in the divine, which has manifested them, and which is their ultimate essence, not in the pantheistic sense of all these forms or add up to God or add up to divinity, but in the sense that what other reality does anything have to draw upon but the reality of God, who is the first. And in a certain sense, the only reality. So in truth, you know, what we are unites us, but what we are against, or in other words, our oppositions, our attachments, our you know, our passions, you know, which all have a negative aspect. What we are against is what divides us. You know, I'm against you because I identify with me. That's what divides us. What unites us is what we really are. So this is a profound inversion of one of the most basic metaphysical principles, and this is what he does all the time. He is either you know, operating on the basis of powers who are speaking through him, or he is smart enough to know what the real metaphysical principles of existence are, and knows to pervert them, to invert them, because they have great attractive force even in their inverted form, because somewhere in there is a truth. And so people, you know, just naturally gravitate toward it. But if it's presented in inverted form, it has a devastating effect on the soul.
Do you think that he has a rationale? I mean, or have you discovered any evidence in examining his work that he has a rationalized, a sort of high-level rationalization, such as I found when I was looking at the work of Aleister Crowley, or the life and the work, that, like Crowley, for example, he identified himself as the beast and everything that came with that. And I think his rationale was similar to the left-hand path of transgression, that you need, you know, sin must abound, that grace can come into being.
Well, that's as consistent as Crowley could get. And, you know, you say, well, is there a high-level rationalization? I'm sure there are a lot with Dugan. I mean, I've seen them. But ultimately, it's irrational. Ultimately, it's absurd. You know, because, you know, since Crowley's proposition of, you know, what he was operating on is absurd, then, you know, it isn't ultimately a rationalization. It's one more, you know, element of chaos. Of course, you know, Dugan in some of his writings speaks highly of Crowley. So that's one indication of where he's coming from. And one of his main doctrines, I mean, if he has a central metaphysical doctrine, is he replaces God with chaos. He says, following Heidegger, he says, well, Heidegger says the era of the Logos, which of course is Christ, or is the principle behind Christian civilization. This is passé. This is dead. You know, and what we're coming to now is an era of chaos, and chaos is the new thing. You know, so following Heidegger, he says Christ is dead, and now it's time for chaos, which he, you know, describes according to some of the terms that are used to describe eternity or describe the divine, except unfortunately he's talking about chaos. And on the other hand, then he turns around and says, but I am a pious Eastern Orthodox Christian of the old believers, and on his website, Katehon, he has beautiful meditations on Orthodox themes, which are, you know, frighteningly true, frighteningly beautiful, coming from someone like him. But at the same time, he's saying with the other side of his mouth, but of course Christ is dead. So I'm just saying, look, you can't say both of those. You pick one and throw the other one out, because you can't have it both ways. But he'll say, well, you don't understand. This is a higher paradox. Chaos itself allows for, you know, all of these contradictions, and allows me to, you know, to believe in God with one part of me and to say God is dead with the other part of me, because it's pointing to a higher whatever, you know, and you're just using narrow exclusionary Aristotelian logic, which is extremely unhip, and we don't do that anymore, you know. And, you know, this is, you know, I've been doing this for a lot of years, so I know how people like this think. And, you know, it's extremely destructive. So when he brings together this coalition of all these different, you know, groups who, in their essence, are all, you know, contradictory and would fight if they had a chance, you know, what happens if his coalition wins? You know, it's going to be, suddenly these people are going to be looking at each other with no enemy to keep them apart from each other, and they're going to tear each other apart.
Right.
Or the other possibility is, this is when iron tyranny steps in from the direction of Russia and says, okay, you've done your thing, now stop. Okay, now what you've done is exacerbate the chaos of the Atlantean world, which is what he calls the West and the U.S., and brought down the Atlantean hegemony. Now it's time for the Russian hegemony. Okay, you've done your thing, thanks. Now we don't need any of your, you know, chaos anymore, because now we've done. Now you obey, you know. And this may be what they're trying to do. Because go ahead.
Well, are you familiar? And I'm not very, but at all, hardly. But with Stalin's Fellowship of the People's program, when they were in the early days, it was post Lenin. I mean, it was Lenin's philosophy, but that Stalin implemented it, and it was about kind of encouraging and defending and advocating different cultures and giving them their ethno nationalities.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know it under that name, but there's a book, I forget the writer, it's called Red Shambhala, and it's talking about, you know, early communist missionaries going into Central Asia and Tibet and Mongolia and this, and identifying, you know, with the messianic prophecies of those people, and say, well, we are the fulfillment of that, you know? And yes, certainly, and you're right, that's exactly what he is doing, you know, and he talks about we need, you know, what are we saying, diversity, and he says every ethnic group, every nation, every religion, you know, is equal, and they can, and every culture is equal, and they cannot be, we can't say that one is better than the other. And then on the other side of his mouth, he says, you know, but, you know, the Russian Narod, the Russian ethnic identity is holy, and the Atlanteans, the West, the peoples, the degenerate peoples of the sea are the absolute evil. But of course, we cannot say that one culture is better than another. See? He says both. It's contradictory, but, you know, you see what he's trying to do by saying that. He's not telling truth. He's making things happen, because he does cop to the fact that the praxis of his fourth political theory is magic. Comes right out and says that.
Which is about propagating or applying certain beliefs in order to shape reality.
Yeah, that's what chaos magic is. I mean, you know, earlier magic, black though it may be, may have been, we'll see, there's a particular spiritual order in the universe, you know, there's angels, there's demons, and so we manipulate this, we use this, you know, like Renaissance magic would do something like this, you know, let's say Christian magic, which is, a misnomer, but the thinking went like this, well, you know, Christ has overturned the kingdom of Satan, and I'm a Christian, therefore, I can make the demons my slaves, because they've been conquered, so I will fast and pray, and get into a state where I can invoke angels, and then, you know, with the help of these angels, I will, you know, abduct or nab the demons and gain control over them and send them out to do my bidding, you know, to find buried treasure, or, you know, let me get next to a woman I'm interested in, or whatever, you know, the magician wanted to do. But at least there was a sense that there was a metaphysical order, you know, that could be exploited by the magician. Whereas when you get the chaos magic, who's that? Austin Osman Spare is the name that comes to mind. He was a follower of Crowley, and he started chaos magic. And chaos magic is pure postmodern magic, because it says, well, nothing is true. Nothing is true. I'm sorry. It's all, life is random. It's all up for grabs. Therefore, any conception we hatch, you know, into this complete formless sea of potential of chaos, you know, we can seed it and we can make that be, because there is no reality out there to stand in our way, you know. And this is pure postmodernism. And this is the point, I would say, chaos magic is the point where postmodernism becomes magic, and because they have very much the same principles.
Well, also, it's the intersection between, with nihilism also, the negation of any deeper meaning besides our own subjectivity, and with the kind of postmodern or neoliberal Satanism, I don't know what to call things anymore.
Well, that's well said. That's exactly accurate. That's what it is.
Because it's a new mutation of Satanism, and I guess what you're saying of occultism also, which is a...
Yeah, and a new mutation of liberalism, and that is not what liberalism used to be. You know, is this Adlai Stevenson? No. Entirely different.
It's like a parasite, isn't it, that keeps finding new hosts, but essentially the hosts always mutate into the same kind of form once they get possessed. So when you're talking about, well, we were talking about what Dugin seems to be trying to do and how it echoes what Stalin was doing, which is this, the glorification and the promotion of these ethnic national cultures and their traditions, but really with an end just to for the Borg to assimilate them, because I think Stalin's policy of advocating those peoples ended up with genociding some of them. So it was completely ruthless when it came to it, and the actual goal was the very inverse of what it seemed to be. It was just a means to an end. But you can see the commonality between that kind of agenda and also the postmodern liberal identity politics, which is all about diversity and difference, but everything is being mashed into a monoculture.
Right. And liberalism is, you know, it's really changed from classical Marxism, which would at least in the context of the West need something like a labor movement to be its concrete base in the world. You know, it became cultural Marxism, and you know that liberalism now is very highly influenced by cultural Marxism, and so but still it has enough of a affinity with what you just said, you know, with things like Stalin's policies to be a vector for that kind of action at one point.
Mm. Well, I'm going to throw something that might seem comes left field, but maybe it won't. Maybe it will make sense to you. But one of the results of my attempt to find a unified theory of this kind of virus that seems to be just taking over everything, you know, one way or another, and just keeps mutating, but it's the same kind of pathology. Or patho-logos is a term I heard recently.
Patho-logos.
Yeah, the patho-logos.
That's good. I mean, it's ironic, and you better watch out using that term, but it's witty. I just hope whoever invented it considers it witty, you know.
I haven't actually checked up, but I think it has been coined. I didn't coin it, so it probably has some.
Patho-logos.
But anyway, this patho-logos, that it's one of the things I've observed consistently as its aim seems to be disembodiment, to disconnect us from our bodies and our organic natures.
Yes, and this is where the traditional Christians throw the term Gnostic around in a very uninformed way. They describe certain things which are purely, I would call, paganism, which would celebrate the body and, you know, all sorts of things that aren't Orthodox Christian doctrine they will call Gnostic. But in this case, that is Gnosticism.
Hmm.
You know, what you have, the Gnostics were brilliant in their analysis of the fallen world, you know, the fallen order of perception, the kind of, you know, illusions that are enforced upon us collectively and individually, and, you know, very much in the spirit of some of the more thorough and mythopoetic conspiracy theorists. But they didn't believe that the heavens declare the glory of God and the earth shows forth his handiwork. In other words, they accepted the transcendence of God but denied the immanence of God. And so God becomes the total other. This world is just a bad deal and a bad show, and we need to get out of it or end it or whatever, you know, to go back to our original reality, which was totally beyond this world, and that reality did not create this world, has no way of manifesting in this world, and so that this world is purely illusion and must be dispensed with. And that includes, of course, the body, because the body with the senses is what defines this world we're in. So, I know. I mean, really, and the problem is a lot of traditional spiritual direction, let us say, talks about the dangers of the passions, the dangers of making, being at home in the world, and, you know, and you know, pursuing security, pleasure, and power to the rather than pursuing God or the higher things. And, you know, yeah, that's still going on, but there are people who sort of given up on security, pleasure, and even power because any world in which this would operate is illusory, and so they just negate all of that, and so what you get is a feeling that these, you know, someone who's in this state feels that he's on the trail of a higher truth, of a truly mystical truth, but it's so one-sided, you know, that it's incredibly destructive and ultimately unattainable, because if there are no manifestations of God, then you wouldn't even know there was such a thing as God, the alien God, though he be, which is what the Gnostics called him. You wouldn't even know that reality is there in order to seek it, in order to try to get out of this world. So there must be something in this world that is a manifestation of that. Hmm. But they don't get it. Hmm. You know? So.
That dichotomy you presented there, which isn't a dichotomy but can become one between transcendence and immanence, it seems to be what's being acted out, because as I say, there's this drive for disembodiment, to discover and have an experience of the divine via disembodiment, whether it's astral projection or psychedelics or, you know, magical rituals or self-traumatization, all the rest, but rather than turning the attention inward to the imminence.
Yes, and you know, and cyberspace is very good at destroying our sense of a physical body and a physical world. We live in a world of images.
Yeah.
You know, and when you talk about something like transhumanism, what you have is both the denial of any immanence, you know, of any good of the body, any good of this world, you know, transhumanism, or the thought that we're all going to get on Elon Musk's spaceship and suddenly, you know, start, you know, homesteading on Mars where the land is cheap, where we have plenty of room to spread out. How absurd.
The
you
geographical
know?
Cure, no?
Yeah, but it's the same tendency. But at the same time, you know, as you're becoming, with cyberspace becoming super volatilized and unstable and, you know, turning into a mass of images instead of, you know, a physical being on Earth, so the body and the physical realm is being denied, but at the same time, you're being totally materialized, you know? You're turning into a machine, so it's a double, it's a double attack, which is, you can't really get more complete than that. This actually goes beyond a lot of the heresies that have been recognized throughout time. You know, someone said in Catholic terms that modernism is the compendium of all heresies. Well, postmodernism does it one better, because it disembodies you and turns you to dead matter at the same time.
Mm. Right. Well, we brought up Gnosticism, and it does seem as though all heresies stem from Gnosticism or return there. And, you know, I flirted with Gnosticism in my time, as so many people have, because it has this allure. But when you described it there, I had an insight, which is kind of very obvious, but you're saying that the way that the Gnostic perspective disallows the omnipresence of God. It conceives of a realm, this fallen realm that's ruled over by the demiurge, which is inherently evil, and therefore the goal is to escape from that realm. Well,
right.
The irony of that, of course, is that it leads into practices that attempt to attain that very thing, which is a realm that is cut off from the divine.
Right. Yes.
Because they believe in that, because they believe they're already cut off from the divine, they're not able to, or we, I should say, we're not able to have an experience of immanent God, and therefore we're denying the true power of God. We're then seeking some fantasy realm in which we can relate to our idea of God, and that's the Lucifer.
Yes, and that's perfectly postmodern, because you know, your fantasies are just as good as anybody else's, because there's no objective truth beyond them.
Yeah.
So the subjective gets absolutized, and therefore reality gets completely fragmented.
Yeah, but you have to, if you're going to create this little, self-made bardo realm, to really settle into it, you've got to actually then recruit others and enforce it upon them and convince them it's real.
Oh, yeah. That's what yeah, that's the other side of it.
Yeah. So again, I mean, I know this came up in our last conversation when I talked about Lucifer and trauma, but again, I mean, having a similar insight about Gnosticism, that's the traumatic blueprint. Because if your environment becomes hostile through trauma, you can't connect to the life force, you can't experience the divine, you dissociate into a fantasy realm, and so then you keep intensifying the split.
Yes, once you go in there, it's very hard to get out, it becomes addictive, and any experience of unmediated reality, even on the sensual level. I mean, imagine, we have to get back to the physical world before we can even ascend to higher worlds from here, what you know, never have there been so many veils between us and God collectively. On the other hand, what the traditionalists say is the worse it gets collectively, the more the divine powers make themselves available to those who are willing to turn to them. Hmm. You know, there are fewer and fewer collective signposts as to the nature or even the existence of the celestial powers, or much less any way, you know, to draw near to them. And yet, they are drawing near to us.
Hmm.
And this is a double thing, because on one hand, this is the mercy of the latter days that, you know, we can turn to. You know, we can turn to God's mercy, or God's mercy is more available than it is in times when it's not so necessary. But at the same time, collectively speaking, if the world is unable to be open to the advance of the divine powers toward this world, then those powers will beat upon the shell of this world until it cracks. Because, you know, this is what apocalypse is. God comes with absolute love, but the world doesn't want love. So, God's love is relentless, and it will not take no for an answer. And to the degree that the world enforces, the collective enforces no to God's love, that love will break that world.
Hmm.
That's what apocalypse is to me.
So it seems like it very much depends on, of course, our orientation, but also where our attention is directed, because since
yes.
the more our attention is directed to the world and we're looking for the world for a sense of meaning or validation or you know, to define us, the greater the pressure is going to get, the greater the darkness
yeah.
is.
And it's hard, is it not, to take our attention off the world and put it onto God, which is exactly what's necessary. Without the shadow of that is denying God's immanence and asserting only his transcendence and falling into Gnosticism.
Mm.
So it's tough, you know. But, you know, what we need to feel is that not just where we have put our attention, which is absolutely crucial, but that, as it says in the Quran, if you go toward him walking, he will come toward you running. You know, God is on the way to us, and his power and his mercy, if we can accept it as mercy, is coming. And, you know, we need to be open to that, because, he doesn't just want to destroy this world because it became that corrupt, although to the degree that we hold on to that corruption, you know, that world that we're holding on to will be destroyed. But certainly God loves the essences of, or as they say in Eastern Orthodoxy, the logoi, the little logoses, the logoi, inner principles of all things, because they're all a manifestation of him. And, you know, if we can feel that his reality is coming and touching the parts of our lives and lifting them out of alienation and out of death and bringing them to life again, making them real, then we will not fall into Gnosticism. You know, we will know that God loves the world and loves us.
You know? Hmm. Well, I think one of the things that is happening here is that the idea of the world is getting reified more and more by the internet, and the delusion that we can really see what's going on in the world and experience, like the Global Village of Marshall McLuhan, that we can be part of the whole world community and the corresponding desire for that. I think that reifies the idea of the world, the illusory
yeah.
world. And it, of course, it's more and more despair-inducing, because the world is getting harder and harder to navigate and understand.
It's getting harder just to travel with your body. Some point, you know, there are too many places too dangerous to go to, too much red tape, too, you know.
Yeah, well, that's interesting.
I mean,
in
the 60s, you know, the hippies, you know, you could, you know, buy a plane ticket to France and buy a bus in Paris and drive to Afghanistan.
Right.
And be welcomed, you know. I mean, there was a moment there where you know, the hippies could get around the whole world.
Right.
And I can't think no one could do that now.
So that goes hand in hand with the feeling that you you don't have to, because you can just travel the world virtually on the internet.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. And of course, yeah, the harder it gets to just be in the world physically, for whatever, any number of reasons, the more people are going to take refuge in the technology and in the virtual world.
Yeah, but and of course, the anxiety and the alienation only grow when that happens.
Yeah.
And so either you wake up and say, wait a minute, this is the wrong direction because it's only getting worse, or you just, as we tend to do nowadays, saying, well, if X creates problems, then X you know, to the tenth, we'll solve those problems. Let's do more of the same things that produce the problems, and we'll solve them. And that's what everybody, that's almost a universal response these days.
Yeah.
Because we don't have an image of a positive reality that is beyond all this. And that's where I say in my book, you know, that an understanding of traditional metaphysics frees you, among other things, from political ideology. You know, you don't have to be inside an ideology. I mean, in this country, what's happening is, you know, we're the country is fragmenting into a mass of different ideological gangs. Everybody has to be in a gang. Every group that you used to, you know, just be your group, and you know, you're accepted in this group, and you don't have to be at war with other groups in order to define yourself. Now, everything is ideologized. You know, your religion becomes your gang, or your political party becomes your gang. Any number of you know, human collectives become gangs, in the sense that, you know, you do excessive identifications with them, become uniform to a certain degree within the context of those identifications, and then go to war with all the other gangs who identify with something else.
Mm.
That's what's going on, you know.
Two embers in the fire faced one another, said to the other, what are you doing here? Although I question carefully your presence, I am so grateful for your company in the fire. Until we're gone, 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 gone. Gone, 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 gone. Gone, 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 gone. When the flames have all burned down, what will remain? Wood, flame, embers burn to ash. Throw the ash down, let the trees grow once again. From trees you cut the wood to build your fire. So build your fire and let it all burn down again. Until it's gone, 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 gone. Gone, 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 gone. Gone, 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 gone. When the flames have all burned down, what will remain? Sit, reflect, accept the heat you feel, though it burns you through. In fire, the flame you are is revealed. This is the change, and you're gone, 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 gone. Gone, 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 gone. Gone, 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 gone. When the flames have all burned down,
So how could one prevent traditional metaphysics from becoming another gang?
Well, Fritjof Schuon was the head of my gang, right? He was in some ways, not always, but in some ways, the greatest of the metaphysical philosophers of the traditionalist school. What he did, though, is turn his world into a little cult, and he did things that really a Muslim, a declared Muslim and Sufi master should not be doing, like doing nude dancing, in American Indian revels and things like this, which really are not compatible with the ethos of Islam. Hmm. But he did this, and he did it in such a way that you saw, wait a minute, that's not going to work. Metaphysics cannot, he wanted to create his own little land of the ever young, his own little paradise in Indiana, and that didn't work. Just as the hippies enclavism in the communes did not really work, because you bring the problems of the greater society into your special little enclave without quite seeing them, because you think now you're free of all that, and they end up blindsiding you and coming up with much worse manifestations than in the world outside.
Yeah.
So, he did that, and at least we can say he showed that enclavism and setting yourself apart from the world in a rather literalistic way is not the way to go. So, somehow we God and the presence of God needs to be real to us. We need to know how to practice the presence of God and to feel more deeply into his reality and let him purify us of the world and all, because the world has many, many layers of influence on us, most of which we're unaware of, and it's an excruciating process for all of this to be peeled away, but it's good, because that way lies truth. And, basically it comes down to what has always been the truth, is like, put God first, and see the world in the light of God, which means see it all both as the manifestation of Him, as the signs, the ensemble of the signs of God, and also, insofar as the world is self-involved and denies God, you see it as the dark world that only God can free you from. So, the same as always is the answer. The thing is, how do we actually do that in each of our lives in these times? I don't say sign on the dotted line, join my group and you'll be okay.
Mm.
But I just say that it is possible to turn to God in that way. And that's all I know how to say.
When you say in that way, do you mean, I know you've just summed up quite poetically, but in the context of traditional metaphysics, so do you mean in the way of referring to empirical knowledge?
Empirical knowledge, you have to see who's asking the questions and how the questions are being asked that result in true empirical knowledge. Empirical knowledge comes from the world responding to the correct questions, and those questions being based upon an intuition of divine realities.
Mm.
And how do you do it practically? I always say, and this is hard, getting harder and harder to say, but everything else is even worse, is to say, the major religions, if you can find them, if you can find what's true in the major religions anymore, they have the most complete ways to do this. And traditional metaphysics is a great help, but you can't just say, since I know traditional metaphysics, then I don't need a concrete way. So what I did is being deeply influenced by the traditionalist Rene Guénon and even more so Fritjof Schuon, and seeing immense truth there, but also seeing that I couldn't be part of those groups when the groups that grew around those ideas. I just said, well, who is Fritjof Schuon's Sufi master? Who is Sheikh Ahmed al-Alawi? And I was able, by the grace of God, to connect with a Sufi order and lineage that springs directly from him. It's not an entirely well-known lineage, although it's fairly large, but it's not, doesn't have a, they don't have a website, for example. It doesn't have that kind of presence, but it's there. And, you know, thank God I found it. And this, you know, gives me a daily practice and gives me the grace to make that practice fertile. And that's what I did. And, you know, I don't say everybody join my group because God has different, you know, different ideas and different duties for everyone. But, you know, keep asking him if you can feel his reality, what he wants. You know, does he want you, you know, some people, and possibly more all the time, although I'm not sure, are going to be told you're going to have to do it alone. But still, you know, there is a renewed interest in tradition, which I don't know if it's going to go wrong or not. You know, Dugin is not helping the renewed interest in tradition. He's turning into a very dark direction.
Does that raise a question for you, as it does for me anyway, but then I'm not... traditional metaphysics aren't part of my life the way they are for you. So, but with Dugin, does it raise the question that, how can I phrase it, that traditional metaphysics may be too limited for this time, as in too easily to misapply and exploit?
Well, not if you get to the depth of it, but certainly you're going to find a lot of alienated, you know, attempts to do traditional metaphysics. And yeah, it is not simply this is going to save you. Once you turn in this direction, you will find the truth. You'll find the truth however God decides you're going to find the truth. But my understanding of traditional metaphysics is the principles are so of such universal application, and they can be applied in so many different fields and so many different levels that, for me, this has given me an intellectual stability that allows me to look at the darkness of the times in all of its manifestations and see, and yes, this too is a manifestation, albeit an inverted one and a dark one, of these principles which never change. And that's a great, you know, a great mercy to me that I have that basis, because it saves me from postmodernism. It saves me from denying objective truth. It saves me from, you know, absolutizing every subjective viewpoint or whim, and it saves me from political ideology, because, you know, if people don't have a clear sense of God, not just theoretically but of his presence, then they will create idols. There has to be something that you really believe in, that you have to hold on to. You say, God, you know, God is a great idea, and I'm sure I believe in God, I guess, but here's something real in the world, you know, a group, a set of ideas, or a passion, or a pursuit, or any number of things. You say, that's what I really hold to. And none of those things are going to work, ultimately, because they're all idols. They're not what they claim to be. They're not the absolute you hope they are. They're just one more manifestation that's going to change. The Buddhists are very good at you know, emphasizing that aspect of it. You know, it's just, okay, you think this is it? No, that's going to change too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and how do you deal with that? Well, you know, the Buddhists are not so good these days at saying there is something beyond all of this doesn't change, you know, because they like to deny any sense of an absolute that could be defined in any way, which is something that's helpful in certain circumstances, and in other circumstances it's not a good idea. Someplace in Theravadan scripture, there's something which says, like, if it were not for the unborn, the unmade, the uncompounded, there would be no liberation from what is born, from what is made, from what is compounded, and therefore from what changes, and therefore from what must die. So, you know, the Buddhists have that too. So, you know, what do? You pray, and I pray now that people listening to this can have a sense that there is a reality that I'm coming from, that they will not necessarily get from me or through the way I got it, but that it is there, and that not only is it something that you can look at, it's something that's looking at you. Mm. You know, I mean, the way we get close to God, we say, "I'm searching for God. I'm searching for God." And maybe I thought I saw him for a minute, or maybe that was it. The truth is, the moment comes where you say, "For all my searching and trying to find him, he is aware of me now, down to my shoelaces." You know, he knows everything about me before this time and after this time, and everything that is in me, things that I have no idea of, he knows. In fact, I am what I am is his knowledge of me. Mm-hmm. And if you can feel that you're not, that you're being seen, not necessarily seen and judged, and initially maybe not even necessarily seen and loved, but although that is the truth of it, but you know that there is a knowledge. You know, the absolute is not just sitting there. You know, I hope, like Mount Everest, well, we found it and we climbed it. Well, no, the absolute has reached you before you ever even thought of reaching it. And it's aware of you before you ever opened your eyes to say, maybe I should search for it. And if you can get that feeling, then you can proceed, because you will be in the first steps of guidance. So,
Well, it very much is that for myself personally, is a feeling sensation. And what you're describing there is, I mean, it's very clear from what you're describing, it's the baseline of our being, is that divine frequency or transmission. And so it's always there, and it's never not there. And yeah, we lose a connection to it, and we lose it as a point of reference. But that doesn't mean we lose it. It doesn't lose touch with us now. So I think one of the things I've been discovering in my own life, which I can see is potentially happening in the world, even if it's only, you know, it's available to everyone, but not many people seem to be able to take it, is we've become so estranged from God or the transmission that reality itself is starting to manifest that. And so and so that's driving us back to it. So a really clear, easy example for me is, you know, I've never become so appreciative of my sexuality or my maleness since this whole transgender thing kicked in. And I realized the world was pressuring me to supplant sex with gender, and to somehow reject the idea that there was an objective reality of the physical sexes. And because I realized that I was under threat of losing touch with something so profoundly real, because of that signaled to me that the reality of the sexes is a representation of an even deeper eternal reality.
Exactly. Yeah. Really. And, you know, and it's, that's the right step to take, and not, you know, men are being victimized, and so we have to join that gang in order to fight the feminists, you know, tooth and nail on the same level. You know, that's the way that goes wrong. But yeah, what you said is so true. You know, actually, I have an idea. I had an idea for a book, and this is a little off the subject, but it's, you know, it's in line with what you said. And now we have the Me Too movement, where women have made very clear to men how they don't want us to act, right? In sexual relationships or in potential sexual relationships, you know, don't do this, don't do that. That's bad. That's wrong. So it's now, I would say, a social duty of women to answer the question, okay, then how would you want us to act? What would you, this is excluding lesbians and women who have opted for celibacy. All other women who between, you know, 15 and who knows what would you consider to be an appropriate, respectful, courteous, and virile proposition from a male that if you accepted it, it would not violate your self-respect? You say what you want. Don't just say what you don't want, say what you want. And then men can either agree with that or disagree with that or negotiate with you on that. But if you will not say, this is what I would consider, you know, a respectful and yet very potent and very virile and also very caring and also mm-hmm. very insistent and all the things that we feel when we're attracted to a woman, this is what I would you know, consider worth entertaining. And if they don't say that, you know, why should we listen to all to the negativity?
Mm. And if they say it, then can we put it to the test and find out if they really want that?
Yeah.
As well.
Yeah. And or whether we're really, you know, it's a double test. It's whether they really want that or it's whether do we, you know, really, are we really prepared to do it in that way, to come on in that way, or are we just, you know, pretending ourselves, you know? Yeah. But, you know, certainly, I mean, there's a lot of messy stuff will happen after that. But at least this cuts through the whole thing of, you know, all masculinity is toxic and finally. See, what's happening, and this is, I did say this somewhere in the Dugin book when I was talking about what's the problems with liberalism. I'm saying, look what liberals are doing now. They're returning to Victorian morality, except, you know, allowing homosexuality. Of course, seriously, the Victorians, especially the feminists, you know, that was very big in that world, although it wasn't as explicit as it is now. Yeah. But, you know, they're returning actually to Christian morality and saying, you know, all of these manifestations of sexuality or of, you know, flirting or of potential sexuality outside of marriage are wrong. You know, they're sinful.
Well, there's the counterbalance or the shadow side of that, which is promoting more and more deviant sexualities.
Yeah, I mean, and that is one of the biggest contradictions in the heart of liberalism. Liberalism gave us free universal pornography. Liberalism said no sexual act is inherently wrong, except maybe pedophilia or rape. But beyond that, all the whole spectrum of sexual acts are fine, and, you know, go for it. And we went for it, and what happened is we got so hurt doing that that now we're flipping back and saying, wait a minute, you know, I don't think, you know, women should be, you know, walking on the streets without chaperones, you know, or something like this. It's good, you know, it's going in the total opposite direction. And really, it's very close to Christian morality. And unfortunately, it doesn't have a Christian basis to make it sufficiently real, but, you know, people are showing, you know, women are now saying essentially liberal sexual morality did not work. And at the same time, they can't quite say that, and they have to be, as you say, you know, promote all sorts of deviant sexuality at the same time. That contradiction is not going to go on much longer. It can't.
No.
You know.
No, well, that's what I was referring to with the loss of the ground, or the fact that we've lost the ground becoming more and more observable and experiential, is inviting some of us back to the true ground, which isn't morality of any kind, except that based in reality. And there are principles that are metaphysical and are eternal, but also correspond with physical, social, even, I suppose, political, although I'd probably draw the line there, right?
Well, later for that. But, yeah, you know, there's an awful lot of politicizing of gender, which really is not a good idea, you know, because it puts everything on the level of power, you know? Yeah, I mean, how many gender studies are saying, what are the power relations between men and women, and how can they be made more equitable, or how can, you know, secretly women get the edge anyway, you know? Or whatever, but, you know, it isn't that's not going to work, because it's so obvious. We say we believe in science. It's so obvious you cannot say that sexuality or gender are simply social constructs. You know, there's a biological reality in symbiosis with a social construct, and sometimes the social construct and the biological reality are compatible, and there you have a generally healthy society, you know, in terms of sexuality. And that, in times like ours, you know, the myth of masculinity and femininity, whatever it may be, and the biological reality, you know, have a lot of dissonance. But you cannot just say you know, it's all a social construct. That's absurd and it's hopeless, because anyone who says that really knows it isn't true, and yet they have to say that because, you know, they're afraid if they admit, you know, the biological reality, then they will be stuck with a hopeless, you know, absolute fate defined by, you know, I've got two X chromosomes and he's got an X and a Y and that's what we gotta be. And I, you know, in other words, you know, they feel there's no room in that. Whereas there's a huge amount of room, because there's a great fluidity between biology and social construction of sexuality and gender. But, you know, everything's getting to be simplified and absolutized. And so, you know, and people actually have tried so many different views and ways and attitudes toward things that have not panned out, that they're opting for a very simple and very absolute principles, you know, or dogmas, which they hope will give them some stability.
Yeah.
The problem is everybody else is opting for that, but they're different principles and different dogmas. So you have an inherent situation of terrible potential conflict.
Right. Well, so I think this is what I was trying to get to earlier with my question about the limitations of traditional metaphysics, because, I mean, the thing that attracts me to traditional metaphysics is that I feel as though I know that there is, as I said, an objective reality to existence that refers to the eternal, but also has its representation in the temporal. So there are eternal truths that relate to the human body, and so there are behaviors that are harmful and therefore immoral to the human body. So that's how I feel about that. But I also feel that to try and create a dogma or a system, which would have to be a metaphysical system out of that, and then that have that as a reference point, is the wrong direction for me personally to go, because where I want to go is to the body, and to referring to the body, knowing that the body is a vehicle for the divine and an image of God, and the body is going to tell me, you know, it's going to lead me in certain ways towards what is good.
Well, I would say yes and no about that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because,
well, there's the body, the flesh,
you know, yeah, ultimately doesn't, you know, it is really the soul that leads us, and the soul expresses itself in terms of the body. But really, you know, what we need to do is return to the sense of love as one of the names of absolute reality. Because if there is love, then sexuality, ultimately, it's not so easy, but ultimately sexuality will take care of itself, because love contains, you know, all of the ways that people can relate, and, you know, and it is also, I mean, if God created us, we in our masculinity and femininity are an expression of God, an expression of God's love. And, you know, because if we simply, the problem with dogmas about gender and sexuality is everything is in terms of power. And if everything is in terms of power, you know, you're defeated before you begin. It's important to see how power relations can alienate us from ourselves, from each other, and from love. But if we say, well, power relations is all there really is, and love is just a social construct of the Victorians or whatever, then we're doomed. Because love is the reality, and power is an expression of love, whereas love is not an expression of power.
And so what you said about sexuality, you could even say about society, that where there's love, it finds its proper expression, or it finds its proper form.
Yes, and you know, and there are people who have opted for social expressions of love in terms of, you know, a sort of a clinical attitude, you know, of the social worker or someone who takes on a cause of an oppressed group and you know, struggles for their liberation, and all of this is good, but, you know, we have to see what it's coming from, that it's coming from love. And love is the pre-existing reality of everything. And if we don't know that, I mean, we will never get to love if we don't already have love. That's what the Zen people say. If you want to be enlightened, first you have to be enlightened. You know, and you know, if we see that love is the essence of things, then we will know how to express love in terms of more limited and, quote, practical ways of helping, you know, or of relating to each other, you know, sexually or romantically. Mm.
This, the world, the configuration of the world as it is, which is so much about abuse of power and, you know, the attempt to gain power and to wield power and then to abuse it, and how love can't flourish in that environment, how that's antithetical to love. I'd say the flip side of that is that it's almost impossible for us to experience love in a state of powerlessness as well, when we feel disempowered.
Yeah, I mean, no one is more attached to power than the powerless, really.
Yeah. So that's what I wonder about. That's why I question, or maybe in terms of Dugin. I mean, obviously, I don't know very much about Dugin except what I've got from you. But what's he exploiting?
He's got an idea. He's got an idea of love. You know, he tries to say, you know, the love of the Narod of the ethnic group. You know, the great waves of love that propagate, you know, the species, and you know, mm-hmm. But it's very impersonal. It doesn't have much to do with individuals relating to individuals, because he says the individual is a heresy. So he talks about ethnic love, you know.
Right. Well, so, I mean, that would be a case study, really, because if Dugin is writing about love, but he's not expressing love and he's not communicating from a place of love, then it's worthless, no?
Well, except as a very interesting diagnosis. I mean, he has things in his books about German philosophers, you know, Heidegger, Husserl. This is very interesting things about Husserl. You know? But it's one of the things, you know, Husserl is one of these non-traditional Germans who attempted to take some step toward mysticism simply through his own, you know, introspection, and you get a place where Husserl says, I'm going to tell this as a story. He tells it, of course, in you know, abstract principles, but the story is, Husserl says, you know, and through listening to music, through meditating on music or, you know, other things I did, I came to witness eternity. And eternity was so terrible that I had to flee it any way I could, and I saw that my fleeing of eternity was precisely what created time and history. And so we need time and history to give us room so we won't be confronted by the horror of eternity. Now, you know, he's right if he doesn't know that God is love. You know, if he doesn't see that eternity is love, he gets there through some, you know, excessive, over-individual attempt to, as I say, raid the mysteries. And he breaks into the world of eternity, and it's just, you know, it's too much for him. He can't deal with it. He doesn't. He has no expectation that it's going to be mercy, and so he doesn't experience it as mercy. And you know, I think that's a lot of what Dugin's mysticism, so-called, is about. And you know, people in that state. I mean, you'd want to be a magician because you want to have a little control here. Don't want to just be blotted out, you know, by this terrible eternity that's stalking us, dogging our tracks. You know, you want to have a say in this too, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, let's you know, experiment with magic, you know, and give ourselves a little room.
Yeah, well, that's where I was getting at with the powerlessness. And if Dugin is coming from a place of traumatized powerlessness, trying to attain power in the world and all the rest of it, and communicating a system that also refers to traditional metaphysics as part of it and inverts it for that very reason, that he's out for personal power, he's also, as I, you know, with Strieber or Crowley or any of these others, Castaneda, he's going to be appealing consciously and unconsciously to a whole demographic, a whole world of disempowered.
Oh, yes. Yeah. To every demographic that feels powerless under the regime of Western postmodern liberalism, and that's a lot of people, a lot of different, very different people, and also drawing upon the sense of Russia having lost the Cold War and almost, you know, and this is very valid. You know, Russia lost the Cold War, and then, you know, the Russians believed, you know, the communism was so bad. Finally, all we have to do is give up on this horrible communism and embrace the West and embrace, you know, Western goods and Western ideas and Western music and rock music and Western pornography and all this wonderful stuff, and you know, what a relief from you know, the dead grim communism that we've been under, you know, and then they were very close to throwing it all away and becoming a vassals of the West, because the West did not want Russia to be equal, you know, an equal nation, and you know, join, you know. The story was Russia, you know, we fought too long, we've won, but we will be magnanimous. All we want you to do is join the family of nations with the rest of us. That was the story, but that wasn't what was happening. What was happening is the people that, you know, in the West that had engineered the fall of Russia said, now we can take it all. Hmm. Now we can rule the world. And it took Russia a while to wake up from that. And Putin is one of the manifestations of Russia awakening to the fact that, you know, you think the Cold War is over. No, it's just going to a much more subtle and much more dangerous phase in some ways. And that's where Dugin is. And Dugin, you know, really feels under, you know, he feels under the United States. You know, we don't know what it feels like to be a colonized, in a colonized nation. You know, maybe we will soon, thanks to China or something. But definitely Dugin felt and does feel that Russia got the short end of the stick and feels that kind of powerlessness. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and I don't blame him. I mean, he's right. He's right in what he says, that how, you know, Russia, you know, seriously misjudged what the West was up to just out of its own exhaustion with communism. Well, now they're waking up, you know.
When, yeah, symmetrically enough, it's the same kind of powerlessness that so many Americans were expressing by voting for Donald Trump. No?
Exactly. Oh, yes. I mean, and the powerlessness is finally, it transcends East and West because, you know, who are the rulers of the world? We're going to have to finally answer this in much more concrete terms. They are the people who manage trillions and trillions of dollars of capital that flows around the world, in some cases, almost untraceably, not through nations, not even through visible banks. You know, these are the rulers of the world, the true oligarchs. And I believe that those people have a big Luciferian element, you know? Mm-hmm. Lucifer, after all, Satan is the prince of this world, and they are the princes of this world, so there's a natural affinity.
So do you think, I mean, have you considered that part of what's unfolding or that Dugin's trying to implement is the fall, well, you have said the fall of the American Empire, but is part of that, whatever it is, theatrical presentation that Trump was got in by the Russians, as so many liberals now believe, and that he's an inside agent who's going to bring down the American Empire?
Well, I mean, Dugin has loved Trump in the past. You know, yeah. Dugin has spoke highly of Trump, and you know, Dugin was interviewed by Alex Jones, who will follow Trump farther than anyone else. You know, and yeah, I mean, and. Definitely, you know, and I don't, but beyond this visible rivalry between East and West, there are higher and more universal forces, economic forces, I'm saying, who are positioning themselves to manipulate both sides. They always do that. As you can see that on the national level, there are powers behind the Democrats and the Republicans who have scenarios. Well, if the Democrats get in, this is how we advance our interests. And if the Republicans get in, we'll shift to the other scenario and advance our interests in this way.
Right.
And, you know, and they're always playing both sides against the middle. And it looks like that is beginning to happen globally. So.
And is it possible, do you think, the part of that global movement involves throwing the U.S. empire to the wolves and just putting the U.S. real estate up for grabs like Greece?
Yeah, it looks like that sometimes. Yeah. I mean, I can't say for sure, but it does look like that.
So, planning to move to Mexico anytime soon?
I was going to
go to Canada.
and be a straight bourgeois middle-class citizen, you know, or something. I'm not going to go to Mexico, you know, is a terrible failed state.
It's very, very happy people there. I mean, I'm speaking from experience.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. They're going back to their original ethnicity and finding themselves and embracing the Mexican Narod, and they're all turning into Aztecs and bringing back human sacrifice to drug gangs, and where heads are rolling through the streets. It's wonderful. It's the good old days come back, you know. So,
yeah, no, I would recommend Canada. That's where I am, of course. But I tried Mexico too, so I've been both sides of the empire, and I never settled in the empire. That was the last place I was going to settle, I think.
Well, this is where I've been placed, so you know I can see certain things from here. That, you know.
Yeah, sure. So speaking of that, you're testifying now in this book, Dugin Against Dugin. Do you have any particular hopes for what might result from it, and has there been any?
God only knows. I mean, I did four videos based upon the book, which you can find it, you know, on my YouTube channel, and which anyone out there who's listening can find, you know, look up Charles Upton Dugin YouTube, and you'll get them, which are, you know, themes from my book expressed. I don't know. I mean, I would like Dugin, Red Ice. You're familiar with Red Ice, Red Ice Radio, Red Ice Production?
Yeah, I was on their show before they became white nationalists.
Yeah, well, I was on it too, you know, and I got back to them and said, well, I've done this book. Would you like to host a debate between me and Alexander Dugin? They said, wonderful, interesting.
Yeah.
And but you know, he hasn't responded.
Yeah.
So all I know, besides, you know, you just see how many people buy it, what I'm doing, my colleague, Dr. John Andrew Morrow, has been, you know, I'm sending him articles, and he's been publishing them in Crescent International from Toronto, which is a... it's basically a Shia publication and website, but it you know, in pro Iran, but it has, you know, also a wider, you know, it's not doctrinaire Shia, and there are also Sunnis and Sufis and other people, you know, from the Muslim world who speak, you know, through that forum. And but you know, I have an open letter to Alexander Dugin published on there, and I have, you know, an article called Dugin Against Islam, and actually that's the name of one of my videos, which is a different, these are two excerpts taken from a larger thing, you know, and so Dr. Morrow took basically my more political things, and I was looking at my more theological things, but, you know, so in other words, I hope to just pressure Dugin and saying, look, you know, I'm going to screw with your desire to get next to Iran and you know, to bring Iran and Russia together. You know, I don't know if I can, but you know, that's what I'm moving toward. And maybe you need to head me off, you know, and neutralize me, and talk to me and put me in my place. So let's debate.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's going to happen.
Well, if you seem as ready for it as that, he probably won't take the bait.
Well, yeah, I mean, he's right, but he's of course debated with a lot of people, but I don't know if they were as, because I'm difficult. It's very easy for him in most cases to say, well, somebody who is against, you know, my ideas is simply a liberal postmodernist, you know, who is an Atlantean, you know. It's very, just parenthetically, his idea of the land peoples and the sea peoples is very interesting. It's got a kind of a cosmological or metaphysical reflection to it. You know, he says that the peoples of the sea, you know, like the British Empire and the American Empire, and which has basically been the liberal world, you know, are one of a great dichotomy, and they are ruled by the principle of Leviathan, the sea beast, whereas we are the land people of central, you know, of Eurasia and the great landmass of Eurasia, and we are ruled by Behemoth, you know, the opposite principle. You know, this is very interesting. Here's where I get into traditional eschatology, because I consider, well, okay. In the Book of Apocalypse, there is a story that there's a mercantile empire, which is very obviously something like the peoples of the sea, which is ruled by the Whore of Babylon. You know, and the Whore of Babylon, you know, buys and sells the souls of men, and you know, her merchants wax rich and all of this. And then, strangely enough, this mercantile empire is destroyed and overturned by another force, but the other force is the Antichrist. The other force is the beast, and you know, it's so strange. You know, it's you want to see it in a smaller framework. It's like the Weimar Republic was, you know, luxurious and decadent and this, and then, you know, the German people had enough of that, and they went for Hitler, and Hitler came in and busted it, and you know, and put down an iron tyranny, and this is what's talked about as happening in the latter days in the Book of Apocalypse.
Right.
You know, the regime of the Whore of Babylon is overturned by the beast.
Right.
And so Dugin is pretty much positing himself or his movement as the beast,
yeah,
like Crowley did, but in a much bigger way,
right,
and a much more plausible way. And, you know...
Yeah.
So, and you know, and what I don't have time to go into, but a lot of what I'm doing in the book, the framework, is taking off from René Guénon and The Reign of Quantity and the Signs of the Times. he was brilliant, and he took the Hindu conception of the Manvantara, the cycle of manifestation, you know, the yugas, the four yugas from the, you know, the Golden Age to the Silver Age to the Bronze Age and finally to the Iron Age, which is the Kali Yuga we're in now. And he looked at that cycle, but he looked at it in terms of Aristotelian categories, where he said, you know, the Golden Age is under the sign of form and essence and eternity and the masculine principle, whereas the Iron Age is under the sign of the feminine principle and its negative manifestation, the sign of substance. And it's like my next step was saying, in the early, you know, in the beginning of the cycle, in the Golden Age, you know, all the archetypes that are emanating from the divine, you know, are seen in their eternal forms, and those become the basis of human society. Whereas, you know, that vision is veiled progressively as the cycle goes around, and when it gets to the Kali Yuga, it's as veiled as much as it can be, and all of these archetypes or archetypal forms, or realities, principles, now all you have is the psychic residues of them. And so the substantial pole at the end of the cycle becomes a vast archive of all the forms of life and the forms of consciousness that have existed throughout the whole cycle. Yeah. And Dugin is drawing directly upon that reality, that archive of what René Guénon would call the psychic residues. And this is very much what Guénon said would be the Antichrist. The Antichrist, you know, would be a heap of psychic residues galvanized by an infernal will. And I think Dugin is almost possibly consciously embodying that. You know, okay, I'll be the, you know, if it is the beast who is the Antichrist, who overthrows the Whore of Babylon, who is the United States and the Atlantean world, then I will be that beast. Hmm. We will be that beast, you know, who is Behemoth, who is the principle of the land peoples, not the sea peoples, and we will triumph. You know, and then what? Well, mm-hmm. You know, later for that. He doesn't talk about then what, except, you know, he certainly has an apocalyptic view of what's going on, which leads him from time to time saying that total war between the U.S. and Russia is inevitable. So I like to caution him, saying maybe that's not the best thing to say at this point or ever. But you know, that's what he goes to from time to time.
So yeah, that's a lot. It's quite a world view, isn't it? And it intersects quite chillingly with the growing view in the West that we're living in a simulation and that we need to make escape from the Matrix.
From the Matrix, let's get out of the Matrix.
Get to Mars. Yeah.
Well, the Matrix, you know, if this is the negative feminine principle, you know, the substantial pole, which is composed of all the psychic residues of things, that's like the Matrix.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's nothing is real, everything is a psychic, you know, phantasm.
Yeah, just dream projections.
No? I mean, Guénon, it's incredible what Guénon understood. I don't know how he did it, but I mean, no one is like Guénon when it comes to eschatology. You know, and in my book, I've done my best to unpack some of the implications of some of the principles he just gave in sort of short mathematical framework, you know, and said, what does this really mean when we look at the world?
So have you considered that being ignored by Dugin might actually be the best case scenario?
Well, I say, and God knows best there.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if that's what happens, then that's God's will. If I continually place myself in God's will and don't forget to do it, and he leads me out of this mess to something else, then, you know, alhamdulillah, as we say in Islam. God be praised.
Yeah. Well, I think Dugin, I mean, he's a political player, so he knows the first principle of, you know, dealing with opposition or formidable opposition is just ignore it. Don't direct attention to it. So if he did do an interview with you, that would direct an awful lot of interest.
Yeah, I mean, I've got his number just too perfectly. You know, I mean, if he's looked at my book, he knows that it's going to hurt. You know, I mean, because basically he's got these contradictions, which are so. Let me see if I can find one.
Well, did you have the hope while you're writing the book, or the doubt that maybe he would come clean and maybe there was a way to redeem him?
Oh, well, yes. I mean, actually, I say this in my in the appendix to the book, which is also my fourth video, which I just read out, which is The Soul of Alexander Dugin, The Soul of Russia. And yet, you know, I just said, all you have to do is repent, you know, and because, you know, you have great courage, you have great insight, maybe you have an element of the prophetic character, and you're not entirely lacking in love either. So, you know, come out of this crap, you know, don't run these trips on people and try to manipulate everybody. You're better than that. You've got something better than that in you. You know, why do you limit yourself to that rather low life way of operating? He's not going to listen. But you have to do that, and you know, and somehow I was able to say repent without, I hope, being condescending. You know, I'm saying, you know, mercy is it can be a terrible thing to face. You know, and I know because you know it's like my wife's book on Dante's Purgatorio. You know, Jennifer Doan Upton is called the ordeal of mercy. You know, that's what purgation is. You know, when mercy comes and, you know, and it's inescapable, then you have to go through releasing all the impurities and all the attachments, and that hurts like hell. So, you know, have you got the stomach for it, Alexander Dugin? Do I have a stomach for it? I don't know, but we will answer that question, because mercy is inescapable, and it's coming, and here it comes. So, you know.
Did you see yourself in Dugin in the process of examining him so closely?
Of examining, say again?
In the process of examining Dugin's soul so closely, did you see your own reflected in it?
Well, you know, and yes, but as this whole thing shakes out, I will see that more clearly, you know? I can't say that I immediately turned everything, you know, that I was, you know, criticizing Dugin about back on myself to see where I stood. I certainly began that process, but you know, this whole drama will have to play itself out before I see all of that. Hmm. That's what I think.
The whole drama.
We don't know what the whole drama is.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not putting any, you know, any stipulations on that.
Hmm.
But, you know, I mean, the book has just come out and people are reacting to it and I'm giving this interview. And what's finally going to happen, I don't know, with it.
Hmm.
But, yeah, I have more to learn from the process is all I have to say.
Yes, well, as I say, I relate very much because I'm still undergoing the process of having written Prisoner Infinity and the fallout for it and so on. It's been an incredible learning curve. So
yeah, I've got to read that.
Huh.
Because Strieber, you know, I mean, are you familiar with the stuff I wrote on UFOs? I forget.
Yes, I am. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So, well, you know, I understand that some of the stuff you must have been encountering through Strieber.
The reason I had to write that book was because I was so immersed in Strieber's mythology that it was the only way for me to extract myself. Was really
And I did that with the System of Antichrist, you know, in terms of a number of mythologies that you know came from the counterculture and the New Age, you know.
Yeah, I know. Well, that book was very, very powerful for me precisely for that reason that you were looking at your own experience. Or a metaphor I use is taking a blood sample from myself to examine the virus.
Yeah. And once we get out again, we get out with a lot more than we knew before. We can almost thank the darkness, but we don't thank it too soon. We really have to get free of it before we can say, thanks, I learned a lot, you know.
Yeah, and then it's not darkness anymore.
Yeah, right. I mean, and you know, this comes, you know, why are we born into this world if the world we came from was perfect? I keep asking, you know, well, you know, the stuff we're talking about is sort of one of the answers to that.
Hmm. And even that we're having this conversation, indeed.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, which almost didn't happen. Apparently there were forces, whether it was our own unconscious or whatever, that tried quite hard to prevent it.
Yeah, but, you know, we have the greatest darkness that the human race has ever faced and the greatest and most profound and most complicated and most all-pervasive illusions the human race has ever faced. And if we can see through that, and if we can survive without losing hope, you know, something great has been achieved.
Mm.
And you can always say, theoretically, but God, if we came for God and God was already perfect, why did we have to come here? Well, that's what the Gnostics say. And the Gnostics are wrong. So I don't know exactly what the answer to that question is, but I know there is a real reason for all of this.
Yeah, It's a feeling again, isn't it? Because what you said there about us collectively, I could say about my life as an individual, like I've really had to go through a lot of darkness to understand the nature of it and thereby embrace the light as much as I have. And the feeling is one of well-being and gratitude. It's not of why did I have to go through that.
Yes. I mean, yeah, I know. I mean, it's amazing the situations in which I find myself thanking God, and I wake up, you're thanking God for this? But it was sincere. I meant it, you know, because there is something great is being done with us in these times. I mean, if you decide to be born, I don't know, and if you're really sitting there and say, well, do I want to be born in, you know, in high spiritual times, or do I want to be born in the worst times? I mean, some people... You know, I'm of two minds. We had veils on us that were so extreme that we had to come to the worst times in order to see through them. Or, you know, if we were all bodhisattvas, you know, we had the greatest compassion and we said, oh, I will come here in order to help out in the most terrible times.
Right.
It, you know, maybe it's both, maybe it's neither. But, you know, we're here for a reason.
I hear a voice that's not my own that tells me to jump into the sea. I'm tired of listening to these words. I know they aren't meant for me.
everybody buy my book, and you will learn how to navigate the latter days and the impending apocalypse. And, you know, this is your instruction manual for the end of the world. Everybody needs to buy one. Well, I don't know. I have to advertise it, don't I? That's why I'm talking to you, you know.
Yeah, I'll tack that on at the end.
These words, these words are yours. I know they all come from long.
That's the end of my conversation with Charles. For more information, click in the link in the show notes to find your way to his work, including his latest book, Dugan Against Dugan. Next week's podcast is a very special podcast with Gib Strange, if I air it. If I dare it, if I air it, you will hear it. It's about involuntary celibacy and the origin of Freddy Krueger. So tune in, watch this space. Though I am on the road, I hope that the podcast will keep loading up so you keep getting your liminalist fix. And if you want to help to ensure that this podcast does continue to unfold, then you can do so by supporting me, donating to Jason with a U at protonmail.com, or buying and or reviewing any of my recent books, particularly Seen or Not Seen, Prisoner of Infinity, and The Vice of Kings.
Some point they become a family of one that speaks with only one voice. Speak with only one voice.